is Friday the 28th. Cloudy and cool, 50-50 chance of light rain, a high of 58. Overnight, get out the electric blankets. Some frost is possible. Overnight low 35. Weekend looks okay. Saturday, sunny and 56. Sunday, 50-50 chance of rain, a high of 63. Right now, cloudy, 57, Racine, 56 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The next installment in the PBS series, American Experience, is maybe the most marvelous and amazing film I have seen from them yet, and that is saying something. They are responsible for bringing so many superb documentaries to the public, but their latest is truly extraordinary. It's titled The Circus. It is a 2-part documentary which chronicles the rich and fascinating history of the circus. A really American-grown type of entertainment that swept the country and eventually the world as well. It's a fascinating story with dark shadows in it. And, of course, the world of the circus eventually came crashing down. But there were decades where the world had never seen anything quite like the spectacle and marvels that were offered up in the greatest circuses of the age. One of the experts who is featured in this documentary is Fred Dallinger, who is a student of circus history for more than a half century and has held positions of authority with both the Circus World Museum in Baraboo, Wisconsin, and the Ringling Museum in Sarasota, Florida. And so we have the opportunity to speak with him for a few minutes about this extraordinary phenomenon of the circus and the way in which that phenomenon, that interesting story, is captured so spectacularly in this American Experience documentary called The Circus. Fred Dallinger, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. It's great to be with you.
I would like to know, first of all, what your very first encounter with the world of the circus was. What it was that first attracted you to the circus? Was it simply as a spectator in the stands? And was there anything in particular about the circus that so captured your imagination that you would devote so much of your life and energy to it?
Well, there's probably a couple of actions that happened in my life that caused me to have this great and enduring interest in traveling shows. When I was a juvenile, my folks took me to see a Shrine Circus in the arena in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And it was something that I had never been exposed to before in any format. And it was just a wondrous world of spectacle and glamour and activity, bewildering at sometimes because there was so much of it. But I think it was the beauty and the color that really attracted me at that time. Subsequent to that time, there were some educational films that were shown in what we called grade or elementary school at that time. And then I discovered a pictorial history of the American circus that really laid forth in many different ways the really breathtaking history that had accrued between its origin here in 1793 and about 1960 when the book was published. So when you take all those things together, that's kind of a formative experience, and then they were accelerated when the great circus street parades were recreated in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in 1960 and had a chance to view those, and that was just an incomparable experience.
The film takes the long historic view, and I appreciate the fact that it does take us indeed back to the very first American circus in Philadelphia in 1793. Although it is modest beginnings, it doesn't take too long before the circus becomes something far grander in scale and scope. Can you just say a word about just how American this phenomenon was? I mean, for instance, when that first circus was created in Philadelphia back in 1793, were they building on any kind of traditions from Europe, for instance, or was this truly a homegrown kind of entertainment?
I think this is a great point to bring up, Greg, and I think it's pursued well within the documentary. Actually, the circus in America is a derivative of that which was in England, which was originated in 1768. At that time, it was largely based on people riding horses, ground acrobatics, and people maybe on a low rope walking across a ring. That was brought to this country by a derivative person, John Bill Ricketts, who was also a trained military rider. He started a riding school here and in April 1793 opened up the first circus in Philadelphia. The word circus at that time meant that it was in a circular building. It didn't really refer to the troupe itself. But what you'll see in the documentary as it unfolds is our culture, barely developed at that time, plus eventually our geography, had great bearing on the way the circus evolved. It changed from being a city-driven institution where it would only be playing in maybe four or five different cities during a season to a construct that moved across the country, moving across state lines, and literally followed our developing country as the population moved westward. You start to see a lot of other things that are truly American that then impacted the circus and made it substantially different in the American context as opposed to its European origins.
And, of course, the story of Phineas Taylor Barnum, P.T. Barnum, very much, in a sense, reflects that development of the circus here. One of the things that the film points out is that P.T. Barnum's first sort of significant entrance into this world of entertainment was with a brick-and-mortar museum, Barnum's American Museum, and it is a terrible fire there in 1868 that sort of ends that enterprise, but we get the sense that that fire was, in a sense, the best thing that could have happened to P.T. Barnum because it sort of freed him up to think of entertainment in a different way, in a more sort of free-ranging way. Is that fair to say?
Well, I wouldn't want to say that fire is a good thing in anybody's
right
life, but it was a pivotal point in his life. Subsequent to the loss of his American Museum at that time, he essentially went into retirement and at the age of 60 really didn't have anything on his scope. But what happened is two American showmen from Wisconsin, William Cameron Coop and Dan Costello, who had a modest circus, approached him and said, "We would like to use your world-famous name on our circus." And P.T. Barnum wrote him back and said, "Well, that's great, but let me give you a couple ideas of what I think about this circus could be." And subsequently what happened was in 1871 they inaugurated one of the largest overland touring circuses that America had ever seen. And then in 1872 they placed the entire aggregation on a special railroad train, and that enabled it to travel further and wider than any other circus in America. And it really starts an era of what you might term the industrialization of the circus, which again is a characteristic that you find only in America. There were multiple troops that moved by these special railroad trains, you know, around the country from coast to coast and from border to border. And again, it makes something that's truly an American aspect of the traveling shows.
Hmm. I appreciated how one guest in the film refers to circuses as a village of entertainment, and goes on to explain that the typical circus would include not only what we think of as a circus, but also a huge menagerie and often a huge museum as well. All of those elements would be part of these large circuses, especially in their heyday.
Well, that's very true. The circus was sometimes referred to as the Magic City or the Wonderland that moved at night. And in the late 18th century, it was often termed a military encampment. It was this maybe 10-acre site filled with multiple tents. It was dominated by the largest one, the pavilion, later known as the Big Top, in which the ring show was actually held. But there were also adjunct shows, the sideshow, which was a separate ticketed admission feature, and also the menagerie, which was literally a traveling zoo. You also had various vendors on the grounds who might have sold drinks or souvenirs or things that, you know, kind of made it an overall day-long experience. People would watch the arrival of the show, the unloading, the transport to the showgrounds, the erection of the tent city. Then there would be a street parade through the main thoroughfares downtown. Then they'd have a matinee in the afternoon, show in the evening, and then they'd tear it all down, load it up, and go to a new city the next day. So it really is a marvel just of magical appearance each and every day in a new city, and logistically pretty much in advance of all things like just-in-time and other methodologies that are strategic in their nature. The circus had to pre-plan everything in advance to be able to fulfill what was called the route, or the number of cities that it was going to appear in through the summer season.
Mm-hmm. And I so appreciate, actually, that the very first scenes we see in this film, this American Experience documentary, are kind of bleak images of life out on the prairie. America being, for the most part, an agrarian society, and life was hard, life was tough for most Americans. And it's important to understand then how something as magic and something as wondrous as the circus, what an impact that would have on the typical American.
Well, you're very right with that observation. American life was very difficult, whether you were in the cities in a factory atmosphere or if you were working on a farm, which was then the most prevalent form of employment. You could look forward to just day after day after day of hard, arduous work with little relief. But it was the revival of the circus each year, which was on a plane with the 4th of July and Christmas, believe it or not, that people really look forward to. It became known as Circus Day because it was such an important event in American lives. Schools would close, people would take leave of business for the day, take a day off, whether it was in the middle of the week or on a Saturday. The shows didn't play on Sunday. And they'd go to the circus as an entire family event. And so it was disruptive of life. It gave them entertainment, which is something that we really take for granted today. But back in from the mid-19th to the early 20th century, people craved entertainment as an alternative to these lives of dreariness. It even created kind of a mentality of running away with the circus, to leave one's roots, leave one's family, surroundings, and run away and join this city of glamour and spectacle and color. And, you know, I could probably tell you a story about James A. Bailey, who was one of these people who truly did run away with the circus. He was born and raised in Detroit. Unfortunately, his parents passed, and he was raised by an elder sister who was very abusive physically towards him. So he faked his death one day by an alleged drowning in the Detroit River and ran away. Went to work in a hotel in Pontiac, Michigan, made the acquaintance of a circus agent named Fred Bailey, demonstrated that he was a bright, sharp individual. He learned the ropes of how to be a circus agent, and, you know, it's kind of known today that he went on to become one of the two principal owners of the Barnum & Bailey Greatest Show on Earth, and later on became the principal in three magnificent traveling shows in the 1890s.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways in which he embodies the whole story of what the circus experience was all about. One of the things I appreciate about this film is, although it really does an amazing job of showing us the dazzling scope of these spectacular circuses, the film does not shy away from some of the darker aspects of the story, including the fierce, bitter rivalries that sprang up, for instance, between Barnum & Bailey and Adam Forepaugh with his own rival circus and other circuses as well. I mean, really bitter rivals in just about every way. The program also touches on kind of a troubling facet in terms of how these animals were gathered to populate these huge menageries. And it's very troubling when we hear about the way in which many of these animals were killed, and in particular the fact that it was almost always young animals that would be taken out of the wild. I mean, it's very troubling to think about this facet of the circus phenomenon.
Well, I think American Experience does a very good job on telling an honest and truthful story. It's not a sanitized version of the American Circus, nor are any of their other documentaries. There are difficult aspects in every endeavor that humankind undertakes. Whether it's competition between troops or the issue of animals, which is, you know, very much in people's minds today as a result of the recent removal of elephants from most circuses, plus the closure of the Ringling Show. These are tough stories to tell, and it's even tougher to tell because you have to get into the context of the time and what was acceptable at the time versus what's perceived as acceptable today. And to judge people on today's attitudes and limitations, restrictions back 100 or 150 years ago, it's an approach fraught with difficulty. And one has to be very careful about condemning people for doing what they did in their own time, just as people 150 years from today will probably judge us in ways that we would not be comfortable with.
Right.
But I think in general, the documentary, the writer, the producer did a very good job on explaining some of these difficult issues and setting them against the background of our own heritage and culture of the time.
Right.
One other issue that was there was the segregation of the audience. Blacks were not allowed to sit with whites under the big top. And, you know, this is an issue that also reflects our culture, but it was an issue larger than just the circus itself. It's American culture itself, and how we acted in those times.
I think one of the important things for us to also talk about is how there was a seedy side to the whole enterprise of especially the Barnum & Bailey Circus, which helps us understand then by contrast part of what was the amazing appeal of the Ringling Brothers Circus, which was sometimes called the Sunday School Circus. Explain to our listeners how the Ringling Brothers Circus had, at least in some respects, a much cleaner reputation than P.T. Barnum and some of the other enterprises of the day.
Okay, let me just correct one fact. The Barnum Circus and the subsequent Barnum & Bailey Show was also a very family acceptable up and up show. It had no aspects of grift, shortchanging, crime, or other things that were commonplace among some other smaller circuses. But what happened in the 1890s, the Ringling Brothers inaugurated what they called the New School of American Showmen, and others in the business kind of contracted that and said they were Sunday school showmen, meaning that they absolutely had a show that was completely free of pickpockets, shortchanging, gambling, and all the other side games that would take money from the people. And they kind of initiated a revolution that made the circus very family-friendly. And that revolution they initiated really kind of spread throughout the business. And those shows that featured grift by the time the 1920s rolled around. It was pretty much out of character for shows to have that kind of activity going on. So by them stepping forward and saying, we're not going to be doing business as usual, they really did provoke a change in the traveling shows. One other thing I should point out, though, and this is a sort of thing that is covered in the documentary, is we also have to look at America's business at that time. And you can see in major projects like the Brooklyn Bridge, there was substandard wire being provided by manufacturers for use in the bridge. There's also the origin of the phrase, get down to brass tacks, so that people cutting cloth would not shortchange women on their cloth goods when they were buying them. So it's something that was not just with the circus in terms of criminal elements. It's something that was, you know, in the culture. Even if you think in terms of the people on Wall Street and the bulls and the bear markets and all things like that, these were the kind of things that Americans dealt with on a daily basis. It was just that in the circus, it becomes prevalent because it's like, why with this wonderful magical show do you also need this crime element?
Right, and the film points out that the circus industry was, for the most part, almost completely unregulated. So it was a place where this sort of stuff could probably run rampant. But we are shown, and it's quite interesting, a long list of the very strict rules that were part of the Ringling Brothers organization in terms of how all of their employees and performers were expected to conduct themselves. I mean, they clearly had in mind a mission of offering up an entertainment in which mothers and fathers could bring their children and not have any, and at least have a sense that they were going to be offered up very clean entertainment.
Well, that's a good point. If you think about it, the American circus lived on what was called a day-and-date system. Most engagements were a single city in one day throughout an entire year. You didn't have a chance to come back and do better a second time. So the circus had to have an attitude of, we have to be on our best behavior, give the best shows, be consistently high quality so that we have a good brand, so that we, when we advertise coming to a city anywhere from 1 to 4 weeks in advance, we want people to mark their calendars to set aside that date so that they come to our circus and buy tickets to the show that we want to provide to them. So they really had to have a consciousness that the circus brand was impacted not only by the proprietors and the management, it also fell upon performers and all the working people at the show to be on their best behavior. And so the whole idea of these extended behavioral rules were to make sure, or try and make sure, that nothing untoward happened between this moving city and the people that they were going to engage upon their arrival. And that really is the background to these extensive lists regarding behaviors, penalties for infractions, and things of that nature.
We have very little time left. I want to give you just maybe a couple of minutes to just explain how the Ringling Brothers were five of seven siblings who each had their own sort of diverse gifts that they brought to this enterprise, and that seems to have been one secret to why they succeeded as well as they did.
Well, it's an interesting story. The brothers were raised in what I would term extreme poverty, and they viewed the circus, which they did see when they were living in Iowa, as a means to escape that poverty. And little by little, they each acquired skills either for performance or business, and ultimately it enabled them to inaugurate a hall show in 1882 and then a full circus in 1884. And what they found was that they could best manage their circus by dividing and conquering each of the aspects that represented the trade. So one would focus on the advertising, one would focus on the ring performance, one would focus on routing the show, one would focus on advertising. Each one had their own specialty, you might say, that they found out by trial and experience. And what it enabled them to do was to cohesively act as a team, and they would make team decisions, but largely it was guided by the individuals knowing each of their own areas of expertise. And once they made a decision as a team, they were all basically in lockstep and moved forward together. In fact, if you look at their correspondence, it's not usually signed Al Ringling or John Ringling. It's always signed Ringling Brothers. When you engaged one of them, you were engaging this full team of five brothers. And I think that was one of the great management styles that they brought, was It was kind of talked about by one of their nephews, Henry North. He said it wasn't that they were so great, it was just that there were so damn many of them. And competitors realized that this was a team that they were up against. It wasn't just a single proprietor. Eventually what happened out of the five brothers, as they started the pass, the other two were brought into the firm. One, Gus, only was an employee of the show until the time of his death. The other one, the youngest one, was Henry, and he did eventually become a full partner with the show operation. But the brothers' concept was so important in the trade that after their success and rise, I think probably a quarter to a third of all shows were all termed brothers, whether there were legitimate brothers owning the shows or not.
It is an interesting story, and of course, a poignant facet to the story is the decline of the circus through the 20th century due to a number of different factors. And of course, one of the moments that is especially dark for the whole story of the circus is July 6, 1944, the tragic circus fire in Hartford that leads to the death of at least 167 people. And a canvas that was treated to be waterproof proved to be especially flammable. It was a terrible, tragic situation in every respect. That, of course, in and of itself does not mean the end of the circus phenomenon, but it is, in a sense, kind of an apt metaphor for the way in which it was all to eventually come to a halt. What would you say is the single most important factor in why the circus could not hold its place at the center of American culture and life?
Well, I think there's two aspects to it. One, the circus brought much that was new, different, unusual, groundbreaking to American lives. And if you look around us today and look at our culture, you'll find that the circus has kind of been infused into our daily life in terms of transportation, strategic planning, logistical motions, color, glamour, spectacle. It's all around us today. And the circus, you know, changed those drab lives on the prairie into something that's got a whole lot more richness to it. So I think it's here, we just don't see it as being here. The other aspect in terms of specific attendance at shows, entertainment's moved forward. We can have the world literally at our fingertips today, whether on the internet or your cell phones. I mean, you can see and enjoy everything visually. There's still that component of live performance that, as of yet, cannot yet be brought to us. But, you know, the whole paradigm of entertainment has changed, and I think it's been very difficult for the circus to compete. They have Olympic-quality athletes, but we think mostly in terms of them being at Olympic events. The circus doesn't present a political agenda. It's not engaged in that way. It's purely one of visual enjoyment where you sit vicariously in your seats and you enjoy the thrills of being challenged or the glamour of the walk-around spectacles. I think that it's hard to recruit that same audience when the kid next door is riding his skateboard off of his roof and landing somewhere on a sidewalk below. And the girl next door is got full-body tattoo. The things that you might have seen at the circus before and being very unusual are commonplace in our lives today. And I think that's probably another aspect that makes it very difficult to endure beyond the issues of logistics, expensive fuel, insurance, and other obligations that any traveling show has to fulfill.
Well, fortunately, people can travel to Baraboo, Wisconsin, and view some amazing things on the legacy of the circus at the Circus World Museum there. And in the meantime, can also view this amazing film on PBS for the American series American Experience. And Fred Dallinger, one of the experts who was part of the film, thank you so much for being part of the morning show today.
It's been a pleasure, Greg. Thank you very much.
A reminder once again that the PBS series American Experience is going to be featuring this marvelous two-part documentary called The Circus. I strongly encourage you to watch this amazing documentary. We have part two of today's morning show coming up in just a couple of moments. In a moment, but first, just a few more measures of Julius Fučík's wonderful Thunder and Blazes, the most famous of all circus marches. This is The Morning Show on WGTV. And it's 8:41 here on WGTD. And to finish out today's morning show, we put away the circus and talk about something just as exciting and celebratory of a different nature, however. This weekend is homecoming at Carthage College. And it is a very special homecoming indeed for the music department at Carthage and the music community, because it is also going to be a weekend that honors the legacy of Dr. Richard Sjerdsma, who towers in a very imposing way in the recent history of Carthage's music department. Dr. Sjerdsma began teaching at Carthage 50 years ago this fall. And I'm not even certain that that anniversary was at the forefront of Carthage's collective mind when it was decided that Dr. Sjerdsma would be honored at homecoming this year. But at any rate, it is a happy coincidence, if it is a coincidence, and he's being honored in a couple of significant ways. Saturday afternoon, his office in the Johnson Arts Center will be officially named after him for now and for all time to come. That studio will bear his name. There'll be a special dinner in his honor, and a number of former students and former colleagues are going to be on hand to honor him and his legacy at Carthage. And then Saturday night, the homecoming concert at Carthage will be geared in large measure to honor Dr. Sjerdsma's legacy. One of the ways in which that will happen is with a performance he will deliver as narrator of Sir William Walton's intriguing work, Facade. And this is also a work which he narrated for the concert that served as his farewell from Carthage. And two of his most renowned former voice students are back to perform Saturday night, bass Dean Peterson and tenor William Watson. William Watson, among other things, is going to be performing Saturday night two songs that have been commissioned by Carthage for this occasion. And the composer in question, Tom Vigneri, one of Carthage's most renowned music alums. And all the way from England, Tom has returned to his hometown of Kenosha and returning to his alma mater this weekend for these performances of these two songs. And I'm very excited to be able to welcome Tom into our studios to talk about this particular commission and kind of the special pleasure that he has taken in crafting these two brand new songs to help honor Dr. Sjerdsma at Saturday night's concert. Tom Vigneri, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Oh, thank you, Greg. It's so great to be here, and it's a wonderful reason to be back, to be honest, celebrate Dr. Sjerdsma.
Before we talk about that, I made brief reference to the fact that you are here all the way from England, and I think probably on the previous occasions that we have spoken on the morning show, you were still here in the United States. Maybe just very briefly sketch a couple of the exciting things that you've done since Carthage, and also explain to our listeners what eventually took you to the beautiful nation of England, which at the moment, at least, is your home.
It is indeed. Well, Carthage set me off on a trajectory which, an arc of which I am still on, and it's been an extraordinary journey. I think I'll give you the 5 cent version versus the 25 cent version. But basically, I went off to Boston for graduate school and ended up working within the arts on the East Coast, Tanglewood, summer home of the Boston Symphony. I then went on to work with a period instrument orchestra and chorus called the Handel and Haydn Society, working primarily with a British conductor, Christopher Hogwood, and then Grant Llewellyn.
One of the oldest music organizations still in existence in the United States, I understand.
That is the claim, and I think it's accurate. They were founded in 1815, though they and subsequent to all that, they became a period instrument orchestra rather late in their history, only in the last, 20 years or so. So a throwback to the time at which they were founded, which, as the Handel and Haydn Society, was in 1815, the best of the old and the new. And in fact, I think one of the oboists, one of the founders of the Handel and Haydn Society, was a member of Haydn's orchestra in Europe.
Wow.
And had come to Boston. we were a lot younger, however. no longer. And then I went to work for a radio program called From the Top, which features America's most promising young musicians. And I did that for many, many years and enjoyed that. We made some television as well, which was very exciting and rewarding.
And you were awarded with at least one Emmy for that.
Yeah, that talks about the capricious nature of our world. I mean, I'm a musician first / composer, administrator second, and TV producer way down the list. I mean, the reason that happened was because we got the great fortune of working with some of the best people in television, and they brought it up to a level that was Emmy worthy. And as a producer, I was swept up in that. So that was a privilege and rather exciting, I have to say, particularly making television at Carnegie Hall in New York. Now, as it happens, I married into a British family, and after many, many years of basically, you know, getting to do whatever the heck I wanted, my wife and I decided to move back to where she is from in the southwest of England, in Devon. And we have two small children, and we thought it was a good time to make a change for the kids to get to know their British family closer, their grandmother and grandfather, who are in a little village near us in the southwest, many cousins, aunts and uncles. And so we actually, the story is that we decided to take a year out and move to England with the intention of coming back. But that was 3 years ago. so much for such plans. but we're happily ensconced there in this beautiful part of the world. In fact, I nickname it the Shire. It's this rolling, stunning green hills very close to the crashing seacoast. And at any moment, I expect to see Bilbo Baggins emerge. It's that kind of magical countryside.
Wonderful. Well, I'm glad it's been a happy move for you, but we're happy that you are able to come back to your hometown from time to time and to your alma mater, which has had you back on several occasions for commissions, and most recently, as I said, for tomorrow night's homecoming concert, two songs you were asked to craft in honor of Dr. Richard Seerdsma. Explain, because you were not given much at all in the way of guidance or framework in which it must be this or it must be that. It could be pretty much anything. So you went to Dr. Seerdsma with an interesting request.
Yeah, that's right. I was contacted actually rather recently, in late spring, by Dr. Peter Dene, saying that the college wanted to honor Dr. Seerdsma, and would I be interested in writing a piece for the occasion? And it was one of those moments where it was very, very easy to agree to, despite the short time frame. And so after that groundwork was laid, I went to Dick Seerdsma directly, and I said, I've been asked to write something for you for this occasion, and I understand that you have a student coming back, William Watson, and his pianist, and so I'll write some songs. I said, is there anything in particular that you might suggest in the way of text that you particularly like? And he sent me, I think it was four different poems, some of the most magical and wondrous poetry I'd ever seen, all relating to music. A poem by Tennyson, a wonderful poem that I began setting but abandoned and hope to come back to by Emily Dickinson called Musicians Wrestle Everywhere, a wonderfully colorful poem about music in the cosmos, and also an anonymous text, which there's a rather interesting backstory to, which I ended up choosing as one of the two texts. So off I set.
It sounds like at least some of these texts were brand new to you. Am I misinterpreting how you're describing this?
All brand new to me. Brand new to me, which is now that I've become really well acquainted with them and have really have great affection for these words, it's surprising to me that I'd never consciously, anyway, come across them before, because they really are really wonderful summations about music in the spheres and its influence on all of our lives. And it couldn't be, I think, more fitting, frankly, to have worked with these texts, because looking back on an incredible 5 decades that Dick Schurzma has dedicated to Carthage and so many students and so much music making, what could be more appropriate than setting a text called There Is Sweet Music Here? So that was all rather inspiring. Mm.
I am reminded of something that I heard back in December. Carthage commissioned Jocelyn Hagen to write something for the Christmas Festival, and along with that commission, Michael Dennis Brown, who is a very well-known lyricist who wrote a lot of things, especially for Stephen Paulus, was commissioned to write the text for this piece that would in part be in honor of the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. And he came to campus the weekend of Christmas Festival, and in his remarks, he talked about how he, as both a lyricist and poet, often approaches those two tasks a little differently. And his image was that when I am writing a poem, I am building a house. But when I am writing lyrics, I'm building a boat. The idea being, of course, that the music is the stream that kind of carries that boat. It's meant to be something that's carried to a different place versus writing a poem, where that might still happen, but in a sense, a poem is written to be a poem and most likely nothing else. And the discussion that ensued from there was that about how some poems are probably houses and other poems happen to be boats, where they really easily lend themselves to musical treatment. And I wonder, what was your experience as you began? I mean, you obviously loved these words. Mm. Did you immediately feel like these are also words that I can set, or where they, in a sense, leave room for music to be added to them?
Yeah, for sure. That's a wonderful analogy, by the way. And I think for me as a composer, one of the greatest satisfactions I have and one of the most rewarding things that I do in my work is, in fact, to set words to music. That was a gift given to me, in fact, by my time at Carthage and by people like Dr. Schurzma and Dr. John Wynn, who led the choir at the time that I was there. And before that, I really had no awareness of this world, frankly. So yes, it was directly a result of that. And So I really look forward to engaging with text, and partially because I think everything that I need to know as a composer basically is contained in the words, and I feel that as in the experience of writing these pieces, they begin actually once you've got the germ of the idea and you're starting down a path, they begin to write themselves a little bit. And that was the experience that I had here with both of these pieces.
Wow. I was going to ask you about that, because you had, I think it was maybe before we went on the air, I'm not sure, but you used the words as this began to write itself, or as they began to write themselves. And of course, most people looking from the outside in would kind of wonder, how in the world does a song write itself or a piece write itself? But I suppose when the words are especially fertile, indeed that is what it sometimes feels like.
It feels like that a lot. There's also, I mean, the mood of these pieces. Actually, as you said, they really didn't give me any restrictions or any rules or guidelines about what I might do, which is lovely. And so when I encountered the first poem, which is There Is Sweet Music Here, which is by Tennyson. And I began to, you know, immerse myself in that world of his poetry in this particular poem. It became clear that this was going to be a slow, longish, languorous setting, using a kind of harmonic world that I don't actually occupy very much. And so I had to really get in there and figure out what it was that I was feeling. I often liken the way I compose to a sculptor who takes, you know, how do you carve an elephant? You take a block of wood or granite and you carve away everything that doesn't look like an elephant. You know, to me, the music is in there. It's almost, and it's my job to find it. It's to peel away the things that don't fit and to let the actual essence of the piece emerge. And in the Tennyson, which is this poem after Homer's Odyssey about these mariners who, you know, battle against the sea and then find themselves on an island of lotus eaters. It's the song of the lotus eaters. And these people are described by Tennyson as mild-eyed, melancholy natives who eat from this plant, and it induces a dreamlike state. And that really created the sound world in which I knew I had to inhabit. And I began to work with the words in that way. And that also then, to me anyway, again, no one was asking for anything in particular. I realized that I needed a companion piece to, after we have, in, you know, immerse ourselves in this world, we need to be lifted up and out of it. And time was running short, and so I needed a text that would speak to me very quickly. And I just last week, in fact, submitted the second of the two pieces.
Wow.
On a totally different text.
Huh.
Yes. Yes.
And briefly, I know you had the opportunity to listen to the singing of William Watson, the tenor, who's going to be singing these pieces, because to some extent, at least, you wanted to craft them with his voice and manner as a singer in mind.
That's correct. It's fantastic, actually. I mean, we've only communicated via email up until, in fact, this afternoon, when we'll actually hear these pieces for the first time.
Wow.
So well, I'll let you know how that goes. I'll get back to you. But yes, I became familiar with a number of recordings of his. He's had a superb career as a Bach evangelist. That is a person who sings the role of the evangelist in Bach Passions. It's a very high, profound kind of approach to music making. But he also sings a number of other kinds of repertoire, and in particular Benjamin Britten, who I feel a very close kinship to, which is really unrelated to the fact that I live in England, but only enhanced now because of that. And it's Britten's inventiveness and what Britten does with the voice and where it sits in the range that I that what Bill brings to it, that I think and hope he, and no doubt, will bring that same kind of approach to this music, and I'm very encouraged.
Very wonderful. And I know that you are pleased to be part of these festivities that honor Dr. Richard Sjoerdsma. I can give you just a few moments, I'm afraid, to give a closing thought on what he has meant to you as a musician.
Well, it's funny because about that. Thank you for that opportunity. You know, when I first got to Carthage as a freshman, as an elective, I decided to audition for the Carthage Choir. And I went into Dr. John Wynn's office, and he gave me an audition, and he said, "You're in." And I thought, that's remarkable. I am not a singer. I have never really properly sung in my life. And years later, I told this story to the director of an opera company in Dallas. And he said, it wasn't, because I told him a story about being asked to sing a whole tone scale back and how most people can't do that. And he said, "Yeah, right." He said, "You were just a man. You're a tenor." That's what he wanted. He didn't care what you could do. Anyway, it ended up being a most formative experience. And along the way, I went to Dick and Sjoerdsma, and I said, "You know, can I study with you? Can I learn some things about the voice?" And he did that for me. And I still would not qualify myself as a singer. But what he helped me to appreciate, to get to know, and to love was the human voice. And that is a gift for me personally that continues to pay dividends, and I feel very indebted to him and the whole Carthage community, and it couldn't have been a bigger honor to have been asked to come back all these years later and to bring these pieces for this occasion.
Things come full circle in an exciting way.
Indeed.
So the homecoming concert is Saturday evening, 7:30 at Siebert Chapel, free and open to the public, and will include these two brand new songs composed for the occasion by Tom Vigneri. Tom Vigneri, it's great to catch up with you, and I'm as excited as I know many other people are to hear these two new pieces